KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Mina Kim. Well, it's been nearly 20 years since Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, put him on the cultural radar, and his new book, Talking to Strangers, is also making a splash and earning a little bit of criticism, too. It examines the theory called default to truth and how communication and misunderstanding between people is often influenced by how well they know each other. Critics say he's oversimplifying the facts and overlooking key underlying issues like racism and sexism. Malcolm Gladwell joins us for the hour to talk about all that and more, and we'll get started right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Mina Kim, and in just a few minutes we'll be talking with Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. But first, as you heard on the news, there is climate action taking place in the Bay Area this morning. It is in conjunction, I believe, with the UN Climate Summit that's happening in New York City, an urgent meeting called by the Secretary General to bring attention and, more importantly, action to climate change. And KQED Science reporter Kevin Stark is out on the streets in Civic Center in San Francisco, and he joins us now. Kevin, tell us where you are and what's going on.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me. I'm in front of the Federal Building on 7th Street and Market outside of Civic Center. People are starting to gather. There's probably about 50 or 60 people here. A lot of students. I just interviewed a group of middle school students from Oakland who said they're angry and frustrated that global leaders aren't doing enough to act on climate change. The march isn't expected to officially kick off for another hour. So right now people are organizing. We've got a bunch of people with signs out here. There's a group of med students wearing white lab coats, and they're also getting ready to protest.
And am I correct that this is in conjunction with the climate summit that's happening at the United Nations?
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been playing out. Well, so the United Nations conference is going to begin in New York on Monday, and they're expected global leaders are expected to get together to start hashing out the next commitments on top of the Paris Accord from a few years ago. So that's happening on Monday. This is all in preemption of that.
And what are these, mostly high school students, or is it a collection of young people from different ages, including up into college?
I see the whole spectrum here. I see some students that are probably in elementary school. I talked to some middle school students. There's a lot of high school students here, and then I interviewed a group of medical students as well.
Do you have any sense of whether the schools are more or less sanctioning this? Are they are there teachers there, for example, principals, and anyone else?
You know, this has been a big issue in the news over the last 2 days. Most Bay Area school districts have said that they respect students' right to protest, but they are not going to give them excused absences. It's been kind of a big deal because the New York City public school system said that any student that has a note from their parents will get an excused absence for protesting today. It doesn't seem like that's deterring any students, though.
And, Kevin, based on what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what are these students, what are their goals? What do they want to accomplish other than to draw attention, which is, of course, vitally important?
I think raising awareness, getting people activated. I think a lot of them are angry and frustrated that not more has been done, that they're sort of inheriting this world that is being affected by climate change. We've also seen this play out over social media over the last 12 hours or so as these marches have kicked off in other countries. I saw some reporting that there was 1.5 million people in Germany, students, mostly students, that were out protesting. Really incredible images that are coming out of just streams of people gathering in the streets. You can probably hear people are starting to chant behind me.
What are they chanting?
They say, what do we want? Action. When do we want it now?
And, of course, their generation and those that come after them are the ones that are going to bear the brunt of climate change. We're already, of course, beginning to see the effects with wildfires and floods and stronger than usual hurricanes, rising temperatures, rising seawater. What exactly is there, you mentioned that some of them are angry. I mean, is there a sense of determination also that they're going to, like, what happens after today, after they bring awareness to this?
Absolutely. My sense is that they're trying to build a coalition. I see one sign right now that says "We are rising." There's a sense that this is a youth-led movement. This is young people are rising up, and that they are demanding some type of action. And the urgency is there. The last climate report from the UN said that by 2040, if nothing's done, global temperatures could rise by as much as 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. And as you said, that can cause rising sea levels, drought, famine, lots of issues.
Talking with KQED science reporter Kevin Stark, he is out in the Civic Center area in San Francisco covering the climate protests for us here at KQED. And Kevin, the organizers of this, or the movement, I guess it's, you referred to it as the Sunrise Movement, I think. Who's behind that? Are there specific environmental and other kinds of organizations?
The central leader behind this has been Greta Thunberg, who is a 16-year-old high school student from Sweden. She's become kind of a voice for young people. On top of that, groups like Bill McKibben's group, which is 350.org, has been pushing this for a while. We had him on Forum months ago, and he was saying he was already calling for a global general strike on climate change. So there's been a lot of environmental groups that have gotten behind this. But I think what you're seeing is they're really pushing young people to the forefront. They want the voices of the youth to be the loudest and the ones that are heard.
This march, I believe, is going to end up right across the street from where we are here at KQED at PG&E headquarters. Why are they the focal point or the end point of this march?
Yeah, so we're starting at the federal building. The marches are starting at the federal building, and the idea is to hit key businesses that students want to see more action from. Bank of America, PG&E, as you said. I think there's also a stop at the San Francisco's ICE building, the federal building in San Francisco for the immigration and border enforcement. I think they're targeting high-profile groups that they want to see more movement from, and the march is going to end today at the Embarcadero. It should last for several hours.
And Kevin, in some ways, you know, California, the students, in some ways, are you know, preaching to the choir. I mean, California has adopted all kinds of climate change policies and reducing emissions and trying to embrace more renewable fuels that don't emit carbon, fewer fossil fuels, and so on. Are events like this happening in other places where perhaps there isn't as much awareness about climate change, or at least as many policies directed at trying to mitigate it?
Absolutely. What you're seeing on social media is this is protests are happening in every continent that is possible. I think the idea is to get as many people out into the streets and provide a sense that this is a global action. Because of the way the time zones work, you're seeing this play out over many, many hours. So already you've got these huge photos that are splashed across newspapers of students that were gathering. I saw some video from Sydney, Australia, where there was just at least thousands of people out in the streets. The idea is to have a global action here.
Again, talking to KQED science reporter Kevin Stark, he's covering the climate protests out in the streets of San Francisco today. And Kevin, you know, over the years, the environmental movement has been criticized for being too white, too upper or middle upper class. And I'm wondering, as you look out at the crowd this morning, what kind of demographics do you see?
You know, it's a really diverse group of students out. I mentioned I interviewed a number of students from Oakland middle schools today, all people of color. You know, this does not look like the environmental movement that you're describing, where it's, you know, mostly white and liberal protesters. This is really a whole spectrum of the Bay Area. We're seeing a lot of different types of people out. You can probably hear we've got drums going on in the background. I see a person who's playing a tuba, a trumpet. Just while we've been on the phone, the size of this march has probably tripled. People are really starting to trickle in. You know, also police officers are here. They've got a lot of the federal building blocked off with fences, and it's really starting to kick off.
All right, KQED science reporter Kevin Stark. And I know, Kevin, you're going to be out there all day covering, or at least throughout the morning, covering this protest. And we look forward to hearing more from you as that goes on. Stay safe out there.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Scott.
You bet. Kevin Stark again with KQED's science team. And joining us now in the studio is Malcolm Gladwell. Over the past couple decades, he's written some very successful books like The Tipping Point, Blink, and Outliers, which examine human nature and psychology. His new book, the first in 6 years, is titled Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And it explores what can go wrong when people who don't know each other meet and interact. And he joins us now. Malcolm Gladwell, good to have you here.
Delighted to be on the show.
Thanks so much. Well, first of all, tell us, you know, what exactly, in your own words, what is the theory of this book?
This book is about the fact that I think as human beings, we are really good at making sense of people within our friendship circle, family, intimates, you know, people, members of our own world and community. But when we use those same tools and strategies to make sense of strangers, we make mistakes. And
the tools and strategies, you mean, like, by what do you mean by that exactly?
By, for example, how do you know whether someone's telling you the truth? Or what kind of inferences do you draw from someone's facial expressions or behavior? Or when you look at how well do you account for the environmental context into which someone may be acting? And those kinds of errors, I think, show up again and again in modern life. And the book begins and ends with a kind of famous example, infamous, really, example of one of those errors, which is the story of Sandra Bland.
Exactly. And that, as you say, that's the beginning and the end. And in some ways, you say that her story, this young African-American woman who was driving from her home in Chicago to, she had gotten a job in Texas, and she's driving about, I think, an hour west of Houston, pulled over by a Houston state trooper for, I think, changing lanes without signaling. And she ends up through a series of tragic events in jail, and 3 days later found hanging in her jail cell, suicide, apparently. What is it about that story that crystallized this whole idea for the book for you?
Well, it was, you know, it was one of that string of very, very high-profile cases involving encounters between African-Americans and law enforcement. And I had been, like anyone, I think, deeply affected by Ferguson and Eric Garner and Philando Castile and all these cases, and frustrated at the same time about how they keep happening, and we haven't come up with effective ways of either understanding them or preventing them. And the Sandra Bland case, in some ways, I think, is one of the most heartbreaking of them all. And we also have, it was a rare case where we have the officer's dash cam video recorder captured the entire encounter between the policeman Brian Insignia and Sandra Bland. So we can actually see what happened. Like, because in some of these other cases, we're still arguing about what exactly happened in Ferguson. We're not arguing here. And you can watch in real time as you listen to this video, the police officer systematically, completely misunderstand who Sandra Bland was, what her intentions were. And it's a kind of train wreck happening in real time. And it, to my mind, it brings up so many different I use that case as the jumping off for the book because it brings up so many different issues.
Well, and you describe it in the book as sort of she, and you just said that this trooper misunderstands her. Mm-hmm. And the thing that sort of sets the whole thing off in a way is she lights a cigarette in her car. Yeah. She's obviously and understandably agitated. She's been pulled over for no apparent or good reason. And the mistake, among the others, that this officer makes, and you can, and I think we can discuss whether or not it was really a mistake or was it a pattern of his own behavior, but he escalates the situation instead of de-escalating it.
Yeah.
And why is that? Why do you say that's based on his misunderstanding her?
Well, that's absolutely a turning point in the encounter, but it's sort of turning point number six. I mean, you can go back to by the end of the book, when I examine that traffic stop in the context of police strategy, I locate the error really in the way he was trained and in the notion that you would send a police officer out to pull over perfectly innocent people on the basis of the most kind of trivial of cues. So she comes to his attention because she is a black, young black woman driving in rural Texas with out-of-state plates. She's from Chicago. That's why he pulls up behind her. And the fact that she does not use her turning signal is a pretext he uses to pull her. He's looking for something else, right? So mistake number one, and I get into this in the book, is she should never have been pulled over. I mean, you cannot construct a law enforcement strategy around these kinds of fishing expeditions where the overwhelming number of people you stop are totally innocent. That is not a way to engender trust between the civilian population and law enforcement. It then goes south from there. He very quickly constructs a kind of paranoid fantasy about what she's up to and mistakes.
How do you know that? I mean, that's you're getting into his head there.
Well, because we have a very revealing deposition that he gives during the investigation, in which he lays out exactly, very clearly, talks about how he was afraid of her, and he thought that he detected what he calls suspicious movements inside the car. He thought that she was possibly reaching for a gun, that she had some kind of nefarious intent. The deposition, by the way, is an extraordinary. It's a funny thing that the case itself, at the time it happened, attracted extraordinary media attention around the country. The deposition, which happens a year later, where for the first time the police officer explains why he did what he did, attracted almost no attention, even though it is just as sort of devastating, and it shines an even harsher light on the way we construct law enforcement in this country. But it goes downhill from there. So when she lights the cigarette, he's predisposed to see that as an act of defiance, when to her, she's trying to de-escalate herself as well as the encounter. She's taking it. She's taking a cigarette to calm down.
Yeah. Although, as you say, she was very agitated, right? Understandably. And she was, I don't know what word, I have to choose my word carefully here, but she was, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but she was upset. She was upset. And she's not a police officer. It's not her job to de-escalate the situation, right? She's being a human being. But how do you, I think you've gotten some criticism over this. Mm. How do you disentangle, should you even try, the issue of race? Or in some of the other examples that you give, there are other, there's the Brock Turner case at Stanford, the swimmer who was, accused and convicted of assault of this a young woman. How do you disentangle? You're basing it on this theory of miscommunication and what's called a default to truth.
Yeah.
So how do you disentangle that theory from these other very relevant issues?
I don't know if I disentangle them. I think in the case of Sandra Bland, race is at the center of it. But my argument in the book is that if we would like to figure out how to prevent these cases in the future, we have to describing this in purely racial terms is not helpful. So it helps us understand why Brian Insignia, the police officer, behaved the way he did. He's absolutely not pulling over a middle-aged white woman in a Cadillac with Texas plates, right? Let's be clear about that. So, nobody is saying race does not belong in this conversation. The question is, what's the best way to prevent this from happening again? And there, I have been frustrated. I mean, I have been writing about race my entire career, but I have been frustrated by the way that an exclusively racial focus in these cases doesn't help us prevent the next one. It's really an excuse people use not to consider the problem again. They just say, oh, the cop was a racist, and they move on. And I say one of the first lines in the book is, I don't want to move on, right? I'm not content with just saying, oh, the cop was a bad racist cop, and then we never do anything about it.
But what if it's more than an individual? What if it's not that the cop is racist? What if it's that the entire system, has bias? So how does that fit into this theory?
Well, that's what the last quarter of the book is all about. I mean, it's when I talk about what happens when we enshrine these kinds of prejudices in law enforcement practice. And so I spend the last part of the book, the kind of climax of the book, is to say that this is not just about individuals, that we have systematically over the last generation in this country pursued a strategy of making sense of strangers in this context, which is crazy, and which leads to to disastrous outcomes, as we have seen in this, not just in Sandra Bland, by the way. I mean, the astonishing fact about police encounters with civilians is that 1,000 American civilians are killed every year by law enforcement. That is a number that is radically out of step with every other Western democracy. So this is an enormous problem in this country. It has been for many years. And I am this book was born out of a frustration with the inadequacy of our response to it.
Talking with Malcolm Gladwell, his latest book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And there's also an example in the book of two people who kind of did know each other, Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister mm-hmm. of Great Britain, who met on, I think, two or three occasions with Adolf Hitler and ultimately decided that his intentions were, you use the word, I mean, you, whatever word you want to say, not honorable, but maybe acceptable. We could live with what he was trying to do. He misinterpreted what Hitler's intentions were, to say the least.
Yes.
And as you say, history has not been kind to Neville Chamberlain. But, you know, that's an example where he did get to know him a little bit. And so you're saying that sometimes the more you know somebody, the more information you have, the worse it can be.
Yeah. So there I'm interested in a very specific question, and it's one that I spend a lot of time on in the book, which is, are there circumstances where meeting a person for short period of time, and, you know, in the grand context of things, Chamberlain and Hitler did not become fast friends, right? They met on three specific occasions. Are there circumstances where the kind of information you gather from a face-to-face encounter does not help you in making sense of the stranger? And in the case of Hitler, the kind of great paradox is that the foreign leaders who met him tended to be the ones most warmly disposed to him, and the foreign leaders who didn't meet him tended to be the ones who had the most clear-eyed perspective on what he was up to.
Like Churchill.
Like Churchill, this astonished me that Churchill, FDR, and Stalin all never met Hitler. Chamberlain was one of the only other, the French prime minister who met Hitler, and most, as this is most distressing to me as a Canadian, the Canadian prime minister met Hitler, William Lyon Mackenzie King, and he was charmed by Hitler. I mean, that's the
hard problem. To imagine, isn't it?
Hitler was a deeply charismatic man. The danger, this is what I sort of get into in the book, is the danger when you meet someone who you are largely unfamiliar with is that you will draw the information that you are gathering from that face-to-face encounter is incredibly noisy.
Okay? All right, and we'll have some more noise in just a moment. We're going to take a short break. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to Malcolm Gladwell about his new book, Talking to Strangers, or any of his other many books. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Mina Kim. Stick around for more of our conversation with Malcolm Gladwell. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here today for Mina Kim, and my guest is Malcolm Gladwell. His latest book is called Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know. And again, the number to call if you want to join us, it's 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch via Twitter or Facebook. We're at KQED Forum on Twitter, or email your questions as well, forum@kqed.org. I alluded, Malcolm, earlier to the case of Brock Turner, the Stanford student who, the swimmer who was accused and convicted of several felonies related to an assault on this young woman who was unconscious. They had met at a party. And, of course, the judge in that case, you probably know, was recalled, There was a lot of anger about his short sentence and questions about whether he got preferential treatment because of his race and status and so on. But what is your takeaway from all of that?
Well, I wanted to do a chapter. This is a book about how strangers have conversations that go awry. And so I wanted to explore, it struck me I should explore the subject of campus sexual assault, which sometimes, not always, but sometimes begin rather benignly with people in some kind of interaction that is in the beginning fine and then turns, goes badly wrong and verges often into criminal territory, as in this case, right? Ends in a felony, several felonies. And I began to talk to people, go around the country talking to people who study this problem because it's, as you know, an epidemic problem. And they all said to me, well, you have to talk about alcohol. And so I thought I would write a chapter about what does alcohol do to our ability to communicate our desires and intentions and motivations to someone else. And so, you know, that case, the Brock-Turner case, is, of course, a case in which both parties were highly inebriated. And I don't think that is the sole explanation, of course, for what happened. But I really don't think that you can come to an understanding of how what happened there. But more importantly, I don't think you can figure out how to prevent sexual assault cases in the future without talking seriously about alcohol.
This was another incident in the book or example in the book that you've gotten some pushback from people. I mean, the woman who's since been identified, she identified herself. I think it's Chanel Miller, or is that how she pronounced it, who was unconscious. There were some other students who came upon them as he was on top of her. And so there are, you know, you've been criticized for having alcohol as part of the explanation, but that in some way miscommunication explains what happened when, in fact, she was unconscious. I mean, do you have any regrets or do you want to explain further what you meant?
In that context, remember, I think that criticism comes from people who haven't read the book yet. So when you read the book, it's quite clear what I'm getting at in that chapter, which is I'm trying to understand how does severe inebriation distort our cognitive processes. So how does it affect my ability to make sense of another person? So here we have, for example, let's look at it through Brock Turner's eyes. He engages in sexual activity with a woman who is incapable of giving consent. And if she were, would have said, no, I don't want to engage in sexual activity with you. Now, there are many explanations for why he would have been, that what I've just described is criminal behavior, right? In the state of California, you cannot engage in sexual activity with someone who is too drunk to consent, right? That is what he was convicted of. So how does he get to the stage where he would commit a criminal act? And part of the explanation for why somebody would have taken that extraordinary step is that that's one of the things alcohol does to us. And I talk, that does not excuse his behavior in any way. In fact, the opposite. What I'm trying to do is to say, when you understand what a dramatic effect inebriation can have on your cognitive processes, you are newly aware of the dangers of drinking, and you have a clearer sense of what your responsibility is in those settings. It is highly irresponsible to go and get as drunk as Brock Turner did, and unless we can come to grips with the effects of alcohol, this case is going to be repeated again and again and again.
And so one of the underlying theories of the book, if I understand it correctly, is this notion of default to truth. You know, we go back to what we believe is true if we don't have enough information. Mm-hmm. So in that case, what is the truth that he...
Default to truth is not the issue being explored in that chapter. That chapter is exploring the second of the kind of themes of the book, which is this notion of transparency, which is what can I tell about another person from the way they behave and the way they present themselves. And what I'm really interested in there is how does alcohol further complicate our ability to make sense of another person?
Didn't we know that?
Well, so it's interesting. There's been a huge shift in our understanding of inebriation in the last generation or so. We have gone from a sense of alcohol as something that disinhibits, that kind of peels away our surface presentation and leads our kind of essential self. In vino veritas, right? That's the notion of disinhibition. To a new idea, which actually was very brilliantly elucidated by a psychologist at Stanford, which is that alcohol is myopia. That what alcohol does is it removes your higher cognitive functioning so that all you are thinking about is the thing directly in front of you in the present moment. And that's significant because it says that alcohol does not reveal your essential self. It does the opposite. It turns you into someone who is unrecognizable. And that is precisely the point of the chapter, which is alcohol is dangerous for that precise reason. And we have been awfully blasé, I think, particularly when you look at the way that teenagers drink today. We've been awfully blasé about how what a radically transformative and dangerous drug alcohol really is.
All right, let's go to the phones now, and we'll begin with Andrew in Berkeley. You're on with Malcolm Gladwell. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was curious about the concept of othering and how it pertains to the concepts that you cover in your book, especially the way that we perceive others in with societal differences, with background differences, or even with sexual differences in the case of this myopia of alcohol.
Yeah. Well, one of the concepts that I explore in the book, in the chapter about Amanda Knox, is the notion of what it means.
Say she was the young woman in Italy, in Perugia, yes, who was accused wrongly of murder.
Murdering her roommate. It's a sort of famous case from a couple of years ago. And that at that point in the book, I'm looking at an idea which bears on your question about what's called mismatched, people who are mismatched. This is an idea from Tim Levine, the researcher Tim Levine. And a mismatched person is someone whose outward representation, their body language and facial expressions, do not match their internal emotional states. And some of us are mismatched, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just they simply don't conform to our expectations. And we have enormous difficulty correctly reading people who are mismatched. Amanda Knox was famously mismatched. But often people from different cultural backgrounds are mismatched. So that, this is, I think, a huge issue with law enforcement and the African-American community as well as the Hispanic community. And that is that there are notions that police officers have about, for example, what does deceptive behavior look like? And they are dealing sometimes with people who don't match those expectations, who may engage in what seem to be suspicious behavior when there is nothing suspicious whatsoever about their motives. In other words, the police are using they have an insufficient understanding, to use the words of the caller, of otherness here, that not everybody presents himself in the same way. Now, that seems really obvious, but it is extraordinary how routinely these difficulties with people who are mismatched affect the decisions made in law enforcement.
Although staying with law enforcement for a moment, I mean, this is a problem that transcends race within law enforcement. I mean, it's not unheard of for some of the officers involved in these incidents to be people of color.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's fair. And I think it's also fair to point out we don't mean to stigmatize law enforcement, because I think every single day in job interviews, for example, this same principle is – and I've been saying since writing this book, have become a radical on job interviews. I really think that if at all – unless it is absolutely necessary, you shouldn't meet the person you're interviewing for a job – for this precise reason.
Yeah. Well, and you wrote about that in one of your other books, about the blind auditions for symphonies and screening out race and the way people looked and how.
In that case, it was gender. And we found that the minute audition committees could not see the person who was auditioning, they started to hire women for jobs at symphonies. That tells you something, doesn't it?
Yeah. Shouldn't come to that, it seems to me. All right. Let's go to the phones again. And Vicky in San Francisco, you're next.
Hi, I'm Vicky. I am a teacher in the public school district in San Francisco, and I teach at a very diverse school, mm-hmm. So I'll have sort of these large population of Asians, African Americans, Samoans, Latinos, and one thing I've noticed very clearly in my classrooms is these kids don't know what to do with each other, the different groups. Mm-hmm. So I've been fascinated by the absolute necessity of teaching just basic interpersonal skills as absolutely essential, in my opinion, strong opinion, more important than any content because of what you're talking about, Mr. Gladwell, because sometimes the results of not understanding basic things about each other can have very bad results, sometimes fatal. And in the classroom, it results in this stiffening, this physical stiffening of the students when they're asked to work together because they don't know how to work to each other. They don't know how to read each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
You know, Vicki, as you're talking, and Malcolm, let me respond to what Vicki said too, but I just wonder, you know, it's also a generation of folks, and, you know, we're all part of this, but there is less face-to-face interaction. We're texting, we're emailing, mm-hmm. we're on social media. I mean, do you think that plays into yeah. what Vicki's talking about at all, yeah, especially with young people?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's two things. I mean, what Vicki's talking about is the cultural dimension of that. But I think on top of that, you do have a situation where social encounters now are increasingly through an intermediary,
digital.
A digital intermediary. And that also inhibits our ability to – I mean, what's interesting about – for example, in the book, I talk a lot about this notion of transparency, which is our expectation that the way someone feels is reliably and accurately represented on their face. If you and I, Scott, had known each other our entire life, this wouldn't be an issue. I would understand all the ways in which you deviate from expectations. I would know that sometimes when you're happy, you don't
smile. Smiling.
Right? Or sometimes when you're nervous, you look like you're happy.
I mean, confusing signals.
Yes. And my dad was this way. You could not tell the way he was feeling from the look on his face, but I always could because he was my father, right? So you have that. When you have familiarity, you have a way of dealing with all of these individual differences. But when you're in a situation, as we are now, where we are now routinely and repeatedly, really in the little brief stretch of modernity that we've been in, but in the context of the full history of humankind, we're in this tiny little period now where we're being forced to deal with people we don't know. And that's really, really, really unusual and difficult for us.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. We don't really think about that. But you know, it just the fact that people get around the world and you're traveling much more and just interacting with people. And especially in a place like, you know, San Francisco, big cities where people are coming and going all the time. Vicki, thanks very much for that. Let's go now to Max in Palo Alto. You're next.
Yeah, thank you. Fascinating. I just wanted to kind of expand or have you expand on the concept of the world leaders who meet each other, like, you know, Stalin and Hitler and Chamberlain, etc., and maybe apply that to President Trump and Vladimir Putin Mr.
Kim Jong-un
as well.
yeah.
And to see who you know, who's doing the manipulating. Is it Trump doing the manipulating, or are they manipulating him, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah. I have said that I think I've written the only book in 2019 in which the word Trump does not appear. And I have been enormously proud of my restraint on that matter. But I guess I would say this. You know, I was struck by I remember reading something about a meeting Trump had with some world leader. I think it was someone in the Middle East. I'm not sure. But and how he went in and contrary to protocol, he met with the other leader alone. And
it was Putin, I think.
And maybe it was Putin as well. And I, you know, this goes to this to your question that one of the and Chamberlain also, of course, famously met with Hitler alone. I think that's a real problem that when you understand the great difficulty we have of making sense of people we don't know, then I think it is important in these kind of very, very high stakes settings to have a group. To have people with you who are more familiar with. So you bring your ambassador with you who has far more, or you bring your area expert with you and they sit in the room.
Of course, he claims no one knows more than he does.
Yes, that's a problem. That is problematic. But that's a kind of, you know, even imagine in the case of Sandra Bland, hypothetically, if there had been two police officers and not one. And then you have an opportunity for the other police officer to say to Brian Encinia when he's getting riled up over her cigarette, oh, come on, Brian, or just even with his body language to signal to Encinia that this is not smart.
Isn't that naive, though?
No, I think there's actually a really interesting research about how police in teams. I'm thinking of something that's entirely different. Is it naive? Maybe, yeah.
Just because they're on the quote unquote same team.
Well, I mean, it's not, but. If it's not naive, if you have an intelligent pairing, where you have, because remember one of the signal facts about Brian Encinia is he's only been on the force for 9 months. So pair him with an officer of 20 years standing, and I think you do improve the outcome.
All right, Max, thanks very much. Again, the phone number, if you want to join us to talk with Malcolm Gladwell, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook or at KQED Forum, or do it the relatively old-fashioned way. You can email us, forum@kqed.org. All right, let's go to Sally in San Francisco. You're next. Sally, are you there? Go ahead.
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead. Yes, go ahead.
I heard Mr. Malcolm Gladwell last night, and you made a statement, a very blanketed statement, that there's no in-between when we approach someone as the natural human content is to be feel that they're all truthful and that we trust them, and then the other extreme being a cynic and think everybody's dishonest. And you said there was no in between, which I completely disagree with. What about and then not meeting people when you're job hunting or whatever, because you don't pick up the right nuances? But for example, I met John Edwards when he was first starting the run for president, and I went to a fundraiser, and it was way before the scandal. And my first reaction was, "This guy's a sleazeball. I want my $200 back."
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was talking yesterday at the event, I gave a talk last night in San Francisco. What I mean is it's very – so in a perfect world, we would be this beautiful balance of trusting and appropriately skeptical. I am simply – I think that's really, really, really hard, and I think that – and rare. And I think that to kind of suggest as a solution to our problems that we just – be perfect in the way we understand other people isn't useful. What Tim Levine is describing in his research is the fact that we have a powerful human predisposition towards trust, and that is a really good thing, and we need to leave it intact and just deal with the consequences. And that's really what I suppose if I was restating more elegantly and sophisticatedly what I was saying last night, that's how I would have phrased it, and that's the argument made in the book. But that doesn't mean there is no room in the middle. It's just it's really, really hard to be perfect.
Sally, does that respond to your question?
Yeah, I understand you can't be perfect, but people do have gut feelings, and that doesn't mean they're pessimistic.
Yeah. I'm not a big believer in accuracy of gut feelings on these matters. I think that
Well, I do. Yeah. Yeah. 'Cause I was right.
All right, Sally, thanks so much for the call. What Malcolm, what does all this say about say juries, who are supposed to set aside all their biases and make a, it's more than just a gut feeling, of course. They're listening to evidence and testimony. But, what does it say about that system? It's not encouraging.
Not encouraging, is it? I think it does suggest that in a perfect world, we would spend a lot more time educating juries, or we would draw our juries from pools of people who were sort of had been prepared for what is an extraordinarily difficult task. It does. I mean, I have a section of the book where I talk about judges making bail decisions, and they're just not very good at it for obvious reasons. It's really, really hard to look at a defendant and decide whether they're dangerous or not.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, it certainly takes more than looking. All right, let's see. We're coming up on a bit of a break here, but let's see if we can sneak Don in. Welcome.
Hi. Dr. Gladwell, I really, really appreciate your work. After business school, I read Found Outliers, and then Tipping Point. It was really great. My question, and I'll take my answer off the air, is in regard to this not clear view of the other person and then how that affects the outcomes. I was curious in how much you think social media mm-hmm. involved with all this hostility and so forth.
Yeah. Well, in my experience, I'm
you've probably experienced some of that on social media.
An extraordinary amount of the disputes on Twitter, for example, are not actually disputes. They're misunderstandings. That it's funny. When I read these things, I kind of try and say, now, do you think, would this dispute have gone away if either or both of the parties had simply taken more time and care in explaining themselves or listening? And it's about, by my guess, it's about 75%. So, yes.
Well, there's also the problem of anonymity, I think, on, say, Twitter, for example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I mean, that just sort of contributes to all kinds
Does
of things.
Does anyone think Twitter is a good idea at the end of the day?
Yeah. I should mention this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer. And we'll continue now with Malcolm Gladwell. And let's go back to the phones. And Mari in Kensington, you're next.
Hi, yeah. I just wanted to mention that what you were saying before about police misreading people brought up for me the fact that I just attended a training about trauma-informed interviewing. It was presented by a fantastic trainer named Tom Tremblay, who has made it his life's mission to try to improve the way that police around the nation treat victims who are reporting rape. Mm-hmm. And during that training, he presented a data piece that was around the percentage of what is thought to be the correct number in terms of the percentage of false rape reports that are made. Mm-hmm. And the data that he presented was that it was like only 2-4%.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think it might be lower, but I was shocked that the law enforcement officers in the room and a lot of the social services people around me seemed to even have the misconception that it was much, much higher than that. And
yeah.
that sort of, it's just very frightening to think that that's sort of the general thought, is that there are lots of people misreporting rape, which mm-hmm. is really, no one would really want to do that.
Yeah. Let's give a chance to respond. Is there a question there, Mari, or just you're sort of an observation?
Just an observation on whether or not Mr. Gladwell had looked at that specifically around mm-hmm. the way that police are, he was talking before about the way that police are not necessarily trained to read people correctly. And I think that that's just really, really important to emphasize when police are dealing with victims. The victims generally don't have a motive to lie.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, and also, I mean, following up on your point and connected to what we were talking about earlier, that when someone has been traumatized, they become even more difficult to read correctly, right? I was talking about the problem of this discrepancy between the way you feel and the way you represent those feelings, and how those kinds of, whenever people deviate from our expectations, we have difficulty with them. Well, if you've just been through a deeply traumatic experience, you're going to be all over the place, and really hard for someone who isn't appropriately trained to read. I talk about, I have a section in the book where I deal with this question of how trauma affects us, and it's this incredible interview with this guy at Yale who studies the effects of. He looked at soldiers who had been through essentially what they call SEER training, where they interrogate them and put them through extraordinarily harsh things to prepare them if they get captured in war. And he was talking about how for some percentage of the soldiers who go through this training, the effects on them are profound. I mean, they will lose memory, huge portions of their memory of what just happened to them will vanish. They will, I mean, it's something that he says that nobody would anticipate. And even though, and this happens even though what they've been going through is not the real thing. They weren't actually, it was all play acting. But even then, they suffered greatly from the experience. So this is the call is absolutely right. This is a huge area of sort of for our consideration concern.
All right. Thanks very much for that call. Just a reminder, we're talking to Malcolm Gladwell, author of the new book called Talking to Strangers, and, of course, author of other books, Tipping Point, Outliers, and so on. Let me just read some comments from some of our listeners here. Andy writes, I'm on the autism spectrum, high functioning, but I have always felt odd, different. Whenever I've been pulled over by police, they always think I'm lying and hiding something. What I'm hiding is that I've spent my life trying to appear normal when I'm really anything but.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect illustration of the difficulty here, that it's very hard for the police officer to anticipate the range of human difference.
Yeah, and in defense of police officers, I mean, they often have to make very split-second decisions, not in the case of Sandra Bland necessarily and other incidents that have gone very, very badly, but, when they feel, justifiably that their lives are
this
threatened.
So this goes to the argument that the book really ends up with, which is that when you look at, for example, police stops, only a tiny fraction of police stops are for obvious infractions of the law. I was speeding by 15 miles an hour over the limit, and so I ran a red light. You think that's what they're doing? That's not. That's a tiny. The rest of the stuff is, a lot of it is this discretionary stop, where they stop you for a trivial reason because they think something else is up. If we greatly limited those discretionary stops, we would limit the number of misunderstandings like the commenter there is describing.
Yeah, and of course, some states like California now require law enforcement agencies to keep track of those sorts of subjective pullovers, traffic violations and so on. Just less than a minute left here now, but what do you think of the limits of your theory that you write about in this book?
I don't know. Am I required?
You're not required to know that.
No. I think what I've written is a highly speculative adventure story that says, let's look at this problem from a whole number of different ways. And it's not intended to be the last word on the subject.
All right. Malcolm Gladwell is appearing, I should say, tomorrow night at the San Mateo Performing Arts Center at 7 o'clock. I presume there are tickets left. You can check that out online. I want to thank you very much for coming in, and really a very interesting book. And I'm sure, how's it doing, by the way?
It's number one.
Number one. There you go. You can't do any better than that. Malcolm Gladwell, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis. Through June 14, 2020, the museum presents New Era, Doug Aitken's immersive installation that pushes the limits of perception.